Good evening, my name is Barney.
Hi, Barney.
And I'm an addict. First of all, I'd really like to thank Monica for what you said earlier. It was really great listening to you, and it almost relaxed me, and then the break, and so I had time to... So I'm telling myself that, it isn't about me. It doesn't really matter what I say. NA will survive whatever comes out of my mouth. I know that. So there's limited damage I can do sitting here for 40 minutes. A minute at a time, right? You don't tell. Let's not project forward. All I hope that I will have done by the time I wrap up is to genuinely convey my gratitude, to genuinely convey the fact that this has worked for me. I tried to I always try to imagine what it would be like to be here for the first time. I've been around for a number of years. It's very easy to forget what it was like going to meetings when I was first around. And it's really important that I do that. And I would really like to say, if anyone's, at their first meeting or very, very new around, and at the end of this, no one speaks to you, come and speak to me. Speak to somebody, Don't leave without making a connection here. I don't know what I would have. I mean, it's almost exactly 35 years ago that I would have gone to my first meeting in London. So this time of year takes me back to those very early days. And there's been a lot of reminders of what that was like. I've connected with people who were around in those days. I'm sure there are at least one or two people in this room who will remember Millman's Street, which was the very first NA meeting on a Thursday night. And it was probably the first NA meeting I went to. And I went to it clean, and I went to it stoned. The building isn't there anymore. It was a men's hostel. It was a really smelly basement of a men's hospital. You had to really want to get clean to go into this room. There was sort of crusted food all over the floor and quite strange people wandering around it's where, and I was terrified. I mean, that's what I will tell you. I was really scared, and I'd gone into really dangerous places, as we all do, without any sort of fear. And yet I was really frightened sitting in a room like this, with nothing inside me, sort of crippled by self-consciousness and, well, ultimately self-loathing, and judging people and assuming they were judging me, and finding it really, really hard to share. Sitting at the back, doing that thing of kind of arriving at the last minute and leaving just before the meeting ended, because what I found so cripplingly difficult was just standing around talking to fellow human beings. I found it excruciating, and I can still find it excruciating, but much less so. But it was really important that it was such an important part of my recovery that I just did that. And I would always, again, I would say to anyone new around, try not to bolt, however awkward or just agonizing it is, just try and stick around, this thing we have here, it's the only thing that's ever worked for me, do you know what I mean? And I mean, the honest truth is, if I could have found a way other than joining in with a peer group of other human beings, I would have chosen it. I would have done it, because this was antithetical to my sort of modus operandi, I wasn't like this kind of total lone wolf, but I was The idea of any sort of self-help thing or just people sitting around talking about their feelings, it just was absolutely cringe-making to me, and it was just so uncool. And you know, I found myself doing a chair the other day, and someone was talking about cool, and I said in my chair, you know, one of the things that recovery requires is we have to get over that need to be cool. And I think I said, you know, what we do here isn't terribly cool, but it might save your life. And so other people started to say, well, I think it is really cool. It's much cooler than stick. And I had to sort of backtrack and say, of course it's cool. Of course it's cool. But in the way society frames cool, it's not cool, you know. Being cool is being like half dead with a needle in your arm. And for some reason, that seems to be cool, not just to people like us, but to norms out there. Normies think that that's really cool as well. And so I had to do quite a lot of uncool things, and thank God I did. You know, I mean, I'm only alive today because there's a song by Devo, I think, called, is it called Through Being Cool? I'm Through Being Cool. And, you know, I really understand that an awful lot of what keeps me in addiction, keeps me separate from humanity, is that sort of need to present some kind of front that's cool, I suppose. I need you to think I'm cool. And I'm not cool. I'm really not. And I don't need to be cool anymore. It's much more important to just be human. That's all I know. And it's only fear that makes me think that I have to, you know, you've got to like my outside. Somehow you have to kind of think that my outsides and all the exterior stuff is cool. And it is. A theme of a meeting, maybe it was that same meeting, was about insides and outsides. And actually, it was last Saturday, one of my home groups. And the theme, the Just For Today reading was about insides and outsides. And, you know, we all know about that very invidious comparison between my insides and your outsides. I'm always going to lose, you know. But what came to me while listening to people sharing about this was, I thought, well, isn't it interesting? I've been the co-secretary of another meeting for nearly a year now. And I have, you know, my criteria for asking people to share in that meeting, and one or two of them are here, I think, has never been about anything other than I kind of like them. You know, there's something about them that I like. There's a spirit. There's something I just like about them. It's got nothing to do with how they look. It's got nothing to do with what clothes they wear, or what cars they drive, or how much money they might or might not make. It's certainly got nothing to do with their gender or their race or anything. Actually, anything at all. So, to me, that's really the point. This is when we talk about this being a spiritual program. Actually, what we respond to in each other, what I respond to deeply in my fellow addicts, is their spirit. And it's a hard thing to, you can't quantify it. You can't really even define it. But it's got nothing to do with the exterior trappings. It just genuinely doesn't. And I mean, I think one of the one of the advantages of just sticking around for a while is, you know, and you sort of, you really learn the hard way that getting stuff and achieving stuff doesn't make any difference. It just doesn't. It might ephemerally make a difference. For 5 minutes, you know, you get this deal, or you buy this car, or that shirt, and all I know is that if my spirit isn't kind of in a good place, that shirt it's just a shirt, you know. If my spirit is in a good place, I can kind of enjoy this shirt, you know. It's interesting. Lady who did the chair for me last night, she said something brilliant. She said, I have a slight problem with the phrase bridge to normal living. And I think, she said, I think it's got a lot of us in trouble because the image of that is that somehow you cross the bridge to normal living and then you're on the other side of the river and you don't need to come back. And I thought, yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, I, you know, when I cross the Bridge to Normal Living and then I sort of don't really look back or sort of come over, because I need to be rooted on this side of the river. That's where I need to be. And if I stay over there too long, I start to sort of believe that everything good in my life is basically I created it. You know, it's all sort of down to me. So look, I'm sort of meandering a bit, which is what I tend to do. What I really want to do is try and keep it simple. I want to just say that, you know, let me just state this. I have come to meetings consistently for nearly 35 years. Why do I say that? I say that because I've wanted to come to meetings for 35 years. Not for any other reason. I have wanted to come. It's been a long, long time since I've thought, oh, I'm at a fucking meeting. I think what I would say is stick around long enough and what we do here will become almost the most precious thing in your life, actually. In early days, it may seem hard to believe. I know for me that it is absolutely, it's what I need to touch base with on a very, very regular basis. I can say that I never walk out of a meeting feeling worse than I did walking in. Never, never. And I 98% of the time walk out feeling just better, just mm-hmm. better in myself. Everything sort of seemed, the world that seemed so stressful, unsatisfying, frustrating, full of people like Donald Trump, 2 hours ago, sorry, I said I wouldn't mention any, you know, I said I'd just keep it principles before personalities. But it's important, do you know what I mean? That guy has really fucked with my recovery, let me just say it, you know. But, you know, at the same time, sort of, you know, I kind of understand that here's a frightening prospect that my work moves me to, let's say, Indiana. And I'm going into meetings and I would imagine that 75% of the people in those meetings will have voted for that guy. And there may be people in the room here who think it's a good thing. So, you know, we have no opinion. I mean, I have opinions, but we don't have opinions. I say this not to make any political point or anything about the world we're living in, which I do find really frightening and upsetting. I really, really genuinely do. I say it because I need to apply my recovery to this stuff too. I genuinely do, you know. I can't sort of go, well, do you know what I mean? Here's a sponsee, I'm literature secretary, I'm like, but over here, I'm raging about all these autocrats and I can't calm down and I'm so upset about it. To return to what I was attempting to say, this thing is I've come because I wanted to come, and I've come because, I tell you, I've come because something really simple happened, and it says this in the steps. It says we need a power greater than ourselves. We also, and a kind of an adjunct to that is to say, our lives depend on finding a power greater than our addiction. You know, it's very clear to me that my drugs of choice, it doesn't really matter what they were my higher power. They were my higher power. Until they destroyed my life, they were the answer. They were what I turned to. They were, you might almost say, they were what I prayed to, because they did what I could not do for myself, which was make the world look okay and safe. Different drugs do different things. The ones that just seem to make all the anxiety go away, for me, with the opiates. But at the same time, I was like shooting up cocaine for 2 days. You'd think that would not sort of give you a sense of serenity, right? You know. So this is like pre-crack and all that. So that was my crack, and it was a horror show. I couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop. So those two, I mean, but they were my higher power, you know. And so when I, you know, the story of my using is pretty textbook. You know, I don't really need to go into, I never planned to become a junkie. I mean, it was not, you know, I never, that wasn't sort of part of how I envisioned my life. But as I sort of grew through adolescence, I think I became more and more introspective, more and more self-doubtful, more self-loathing, just more disconnected from people. I'm not sure that I ever was really honest with anybody about how I was feeling. And they really probably weren't honest with me. I mean, we don't grow up in a culture where kids are encouraged. My family did not encourage me to be honest. I was punished for being honest or expressing a feeling. So I learned pretty quickly, as I imagine many of us do, that it was not okay to have feelings. It was certainly not okay to express them. And so, you know, by the time I was, you know, in my teenage years, I was busy not feeling. I was busy trying to find ways not to feel, you know. So you know, alcohol, speak, whatever the drugs were. I found opiates. I basically used with a guy who was my mentor, my narcotic mentor, and he was one step ahead of me the whole way. And he's still a friend of mine today. Thank God we're both still alive. But I ended up saying to him, yes, stick a needle in my arm. I still don't know why I did it. I knew what happened to people who did that. And I don't know what I thought. I probably thought, it won't happen to me. I'll be all right. I'll be able to handle it. And some people can handle it. I used with people who, I stuck needles in their arms and they're not addicts. So, you know, it's the addiction doesn't come in the barrel. It doesn't come in the packet. This, I think we all know this. But for me, the moment I felt that sensation, I was like, I've come home. This is it. I mean, this is, why didn't they tell me about this when I was like five or something, you know? Not that I would have been sticking needles in my arms at five, but I was like, this is how I've always wanted to feel, or rather not feel. Because this is it. This thing is running through my bloodstream, and I don't give a fuck what's going to happen now. I don't care. 2 hours ago, I was really worried about tomorrow or some job interview or something or a girl who wasn't returning my call or something. And suddenly it just all went away and I was just floating through the cosmos. You know. And so that was it. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm on. Yeah. And I was just from that moment on, it was like, I don't want to not feel like this ever, really. It's the truth. And so it was a fairly rapid progression. It took me, I was doing geographicals pretty quickly, to be honest with you. And the major one that I did that brought me to my rock bottom was, you know, I decided it was a really smart place, because you talked about that lovely idea. I'll get on a plane to there and it'll be different. Everything will be different. There'll be a different me waiting at the airport for me. Right? You know, and you get off the plane and there you are. You know, and it's, oh shit, that didn't work. I decided California was a really smart place to go. You know, no drugs there, right? So, yeah, and long story short, I was, after a year there of a lot of desperate and pretty undignified using, a lot of it involving ripping off the girl that I had taken hostage, who probably saved my life, and I just used her. I was just utterly self-centered and kind of suicidal, kind of like, there's no point. I mean, I'm never going to make anything in my life. Like, I can't even get back to London. Nobody gives a shit. You know, just horrible, really horrible. I mean, I sort of ended up literally sort of, she'd go to work and I'd sit and watch soap operas, drinking cans of beer, and like seeing if I could find her checkbook so I could forge a check. And you know, I mean, it wasn't sort of glamorous using, and I felt shitty about myself. And I went to a meeting one night. She had a mate, and I struck some kind of deal with her She said, if the dealer doesn't call by 7, will you promise to go to this meeting? And I went to this meeting. And kind of, so it was like this. It was probably about the size of this. It was in Beverly Hills. Not the very posh part of Beverly Hills, the slums of Beverly Hills. There's a movie, I think, the slums of Beverly Hills, which of course are not very slum-like. But I went in there with this guy, and I sat, and I had mixed feelings because I heard American people talking about God, and I thought this doesn't sound good at all, you know. But I also heard, and I can almost hear their voices. I think there were two or three speakers, and I heard them talking about their feelings. I heard them talking about these things called feelings. And I heard them talking about why they had used. And I heard them talk about the feelings that they were having as a result of not using. And it was like, I just sort of sat there open mouthed, because I just didn't know that anyone on earth had feelings like this. No one had ever opened up in that way to me, either just like one-on-one or in a group or a meet. I mean, just it never happened. And I thought, wow, you know, maybe I'm not a freak. Maybe I'm just, you know, and I sort of walked out and I thought, I think I need some help. I think I don't think I'm ever going to be. I didn't think I would ever not want to use. I mean, that was, I thought, maybe I can stop using, but I can't really imagine ever not wanting to do that shit to myself, because I, you know, for 5 years, I have been absolutely obsessed by nothing else, you know. So the idea that I would wake up and not want to stick a needle in mine was sort of like, I just had to take it on trust that maybe I wouldn't one day, you know. And I came back to London. So I came back to London, it was about 35 years ago. And it was hot, and it's very like it is now. It's weird, and I relapsed a couple of times, and then on August the 25th, 1983, I woke up in the morning and I made a decision to ask this thing called God, whatever the hell it was, to help me not to pick up for that day. That was the real beginning of my journey. And it's important for me to tell you that I have done that every single day since. You know, it may just be a coincidence that I haven't used it, but I'm not about to put it to the test. You know, let's see what happens if I don't pray. You know, so I've just done that routinely every day, wherever I've been, whoever I've been with, you know, and I, that's the beginning of my day. You know, other stuff happens, but that's the beginning of every day. What have you got to lose, right? Maybe there is something. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I'm not anti-religion either. What I did understand, and this is, you know, coming a long way back to what I was launching into, is that this idea of a power greater than myself. So if heroin and coke and all, if that was my higher power, then in order not to do that to myself every day, I'm going to need a power greater than that. So that idea that there's got to be a power that's greater than the obsession and compulsion to use, that sort of took root for me with step two. And I think I, at least theoretically or in some abstract way, began to understand that it was possible that a room full of human beings, recovering addicts, sitting around together, caring for each other, and listening to each other, and hugging each other. So I do get a bit tearful sometimes, because it's, yeah. Maybe that is a power greater than the obsession with obliterating myself, getting out of my head, that desperate need to get out of my head. Turns out it was true for me. It may not be true for everyone. I have no right to say that applies to everyone. You know, we're very damaged people, and I do genuinely believe some of us are more damaged than others. However, I have seen people with the most horrendous stories, far more horrendous than mine, who have been clean at least as long as I've been clean. So I have to believe it's possible that by surrendering to this thing and letting us into your life, letting you into my life, just opening that door a little peep, Don't be scared. No one's gonna turn on you here. No one is going to. We're all here for each other. We genuinely are, you know. We may not all love each other to death, you know. That's just human. But like someone said at a meeting, nobody sits in these meetings begrudging someone going up for a 90-day keyring. Or a 10-year chip, or whatever the hell, a medallion. You know, no one's sitting there thinking, I wish you didn't have that. You shouldn't have that. So I've got about 10 minutes left. What happened for me, someone said the first three steps were quite simple. Step one says, I can't do it. Just can't do it. Everything, can't do anything. I can't get clean. I can't do life. I don't understand how life works. I can't do this. Step two says, it can. I prefer to use the word it. You could use she or he, but let's just say it can. It can do it. And step three just says, let it. Let it work. You know, jump in and let this work for you. Try to turn off that cynical, critical voice that says, yeah, well, not for me. It's not going to work for me, you know. And it's uncool. And I'm always on the outside and I don't need this. And truth is, what that says is I hate myself so much that I'm not willing to embrace this because I don't really think I deserve it. And these people who look so happy and they're hugging each other, they're never going to hug me. You know, at the root of everything, all this program is really about is love. That's all it's really about. Because my understanding of it is that if I love myself, I'm not going to use. I won't need to use. If I hate myself, I probably will use. I may well use, you know. But let me just make this very clear. I've hated myself a lot in recovery. I don't seem to hate myself that much anymore. And maybe that's just getting old, you know. It's hard to know. Do you know what I mean? You know, some things just happen as a result of not dying, you know. And so I can't sort of say, you know, sometimes it's like, it's all very well for a 59-year-old man like me to say to a 21-year-old guy, this is what you need to do, or what I suggest you do, because it just might not apply to him. I don't know. I can only tell you what I've done. So the bottom line is, I think I did surrender. I think I just said, you know what? People said to me, if you put this before everything else in your life, everything will be all right. Everything will fall into place. That has been my experience. And I think, and I say this without any judgment, I have seen, as I'm sure we all have, I've seen plenty of people put plenty of other things before this. And whatever the end game of that is, what I see is incredible suffering and pain. You know, you put a relationship before this, you put a job or money or, again, you know, people said to me, you'll lose those things and you'll lose your recovery. I mean, I know it sounds a bit hard line, but I mean, for me, I kind of said, okay, I'll take that on trust. And so I think there was a period in my life, when I was living in America, I had a very young family, I was having to work incredibly hard, and I would say that's as close as I've come to not putting this first. I went to one meeting a week, I didn't share very often, I felt a bit out of place, like I'm not American, you know, it was all bullshit. I didn't want to use, but I was very in self-will, let me tell you, I wasn't very happy, I was very scared about money running out and not being able to provide. So that was a lesson for me. Came back to London, late 99, summer 99, and I would say that I have absolutely put the program first ever since. And the result of that is that, you know, life's really okay. it's really okay. It just seems to be okay when I do about 3 meetings a week minimum. I try and do, sometimes do 4, but I tend to do a minimum of 3 a week. And that kind of works. It doesn't take me very long to just go a bit nuts again. So like 1 a week, I'd be, by day 6, I would be nuts again. I'd be back in, I mean, it's just for me. It's just for me. But it's so I've continued to come. I've done, we're close to 6 minutes left. How can I mean, I did what was suggested. I've had 3 sponsors. I worked my way through the 12 steps with my second sponsor. So I would say that 4 and 5 were a massive before and after about with that process. I would say that before 4, I didn't really have a clue who I was. I would say that after 5, I had quite a painful sense of who I was. And I experienced that pain through 6 and 7, and I really came to terms with how much I loathed myself deep down, how ashamed I was, how I just assumed that people didn't like me, just such ingrained self-loathing. And I think I've spent the remaining years sort of recovering from that. And I think one of the greatest gifts that comes along in recovery, you know, and it's not sort of some permanent thing, but there's a moment when you sort of think, actually, I don't really care what anybody else thinks of me, you know. Thanks, Tony. You know, not in a contemptuous way, not like, I give a fuck. I mean, you know, I mean, if you told me you didn't like me, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to be like, it doesn't affect me. Water off the duck's back. Of course not. But actually, I really do understand, with the help of the people who supported me in my recovery, is that the only opinion that really matters is my opinion of myself. Do you know? Do I like me or not? You know, people are not going to like me, and they're welcome to that. There's some people I don't like. Who gives a fuck? Do you know what I mean? I mean, really, really, who gives a fuck? I mean, just, but so insecure can I be? I would say what I really want to kind of finish up by saying is that I've been through some testing things in recovery. I've been probably the most difficult, traumatic, was divorce with 3 young children. There've been disappointments, there've been obsessive feelings for unavailable women, of course, inevitably. What man in recovery cannot speak of such things? you know, and so, like it says at the beginning, I'm a book a lot of us have read, The Life, what are the first 3 words of The Road Less Traveled? Not approved literature, by the way, but life is suffering. Life is suffering. One of the things that I really, really had to get over was this idea that life should not be suffering, you know. I had this idea that if I kind of did everything right and worked all the steps, and you know, then there would never be any pain. I'd just sort of float above all these human things. It turns out it's not true. Things happen in life. Things don't work out the way that you hope they'll work. There are massive disappointments. I think life will always disappoint because the self-centeredness of the addict demands so much of the world, you know. And I think the huge turnaround for me in the last sort of few years has been a genuine sense of, I actually don't expect anything anymore. I really genuinely don't. The glass half empty, for the most part, really is a glass. I mean, it's just so easy, I think, to take for granted what one is given in these rooms and through this program and through the steps. And it's sort of, the absolute core of this illness is that however much you get, it's never enough. Right? It's never enough. You get the biggest fucking record deal ever, and the next day, it's not enough. He's got more. You know, I read about these miserable billionaires, you know, who have less billions than that guy in that house with the underground fucking, you know, swimming pool and cinema. And it's like, I think there came a moment for me where I sort of understood there will never be enough. So how about we turn it on its head and say, it's already enough. What I've got and who I am, it's enough. could that possibly be true? Well, in a way, it has to be true. It sort of has to be true. It's the only way for me to live a day at a time and to feel like okay in this world is to say, it's already enough. Whatever's going on, and there may be painful, difficult things, but that gnawing sense of there's something missing. There's something not right. And this would fix it. I think I've let go of that now, you know. And I tell you what, it's. I'm not scared of death. I accept death. It's a complete mystery to me how we come into this world and then we're gone. You know, it's just incredibly sad, isn't it? It's sort of heartbreaking, but it's also why life is so magical and beautiful, you know. And I haven't even talked about my marriage or my kids or my work or, you know, I'm married for the second time very happily, for the most part. 13 years in, you know, it's a challenge to, it's a challenge sometimes to keep it really fresh, to find something new in each other, you know. Do you want me to shut up now? There's never enough time. No. But you know, if my wife found out that I hadn't given her a name check, you know, not she would, but she might listen to this one day. I love you very much, darling, and I love a lot of people in this room, and I have love for everybody in this room, and you know, if you're new around, please just give it your best shot. Just keep coming until it kind of sinks in, and you know that you belong here. Thank you.
Thanks, Barney.
Thank you.